Welcome to the Mentors Project podcast, covering mentorship, books, and more. In this podcast, we interview the authors of a new series of books, where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Our guest today is Adam Parker, author of The Divine Proportions of Luca Pacioli, a novel based on the life of Luca Pacioli. Known as the father of accounting and bookkeeping in Europe, Pacioli was a friar who worked with, among others, Leonardo da Vinci. My favorite first question is always, why does Pacioli matter to us today?
Well, there's the very rote answer of, because the foundation of all contemporary monetary systems is double-entry bookkeeping. But more importantly, and you know, not to be too grandiose, but it's a way of scientific thinking that was just coming into being in the Renaissance. It's a way of thinking about the world that is now so pervasive, we might think of it as the air around us. Because it's a way of thinking that helps us determine what exists in the world, and what we know exists, and how to prove that we know something exists. It's a way of building trust, not in just global trade, but with people in other lands who you may not have a common language or religion with, but you have to learn how to trust them and trade with them. It's a system of understanding that transcends culture and connects people, which has led us to the interconnected world we have today.
How then do you think his childhood helped form who he became later in life, this fascination with this new system?
Well, you know, that's probably one of the most interesting things and most interesting ways that I got to really put my stamp on his life, because I had to fictionalize much of his childhood, because there was little to no information about where he actually was, born in Sansepolcro, in a rough range of time, and then he leaves for Venice in his late teens. And, you know, that's about much what we know. But it gave me a big opportunity to dive into the world and figure out what might have set him on the path, including, you know, watching a game called The Battle of the Stones, which was, you may have guessed it by the name of the title, a game where people threw rocks at each other in an open field. And in the novel, it was really fun explaining the rules of that game. And then also things like the beans. When a child was born in Sansepolcro in Italy, where he grew up, they would place a bean in a box in the church. Black beans for boys and white beans for girls. But they would never take a bean away when someone dies. So for someone like a young Luca Pacioli wanting to know the population of his town at the time, it's an infuriating system because it's a way of keeping track of people without actually keeping track of them. Because they never take a bean away when somebody dies, there's no checks and balances. There's no debits to the credits, which is something that he becomes much more involved with later in his life.
Well, I find that fascinating because the idea is it's a good way to keep track of how many births there have been. But you're right, there's no way to know how to take out the deaths. And that bothered him as a young child, or something bothered him that made him think about this system.
Yes, it's part of the, you know, laying out the trajectory of his life and thinking of things in his world that give you an idea of what the world is like, where he came from, so that when he does get more into codifying double-entry bookkeeping later, you can see where the world is and how this system is going to revolutionize ways of thought.
Brilliant. I love that. I love that aspect of the business of fictionalizing these people's lives, because there isn't that much research about them. All right, so what were you able to find about the relationships in life that fueled him? Who was really important to him in the early days?
Luca was really lucky to have two great mentors in his life, both Renaissance men, you know, as it were. But Leon Battista Alberti was more focused on architecture, and his other mentor, Piero della Francesca, was more of a painter. But it was interesting because Luca didn't have these two separate mentors. It was more of a mentorship triangle, because Alberti mentored Piero, and Piero had taken Alberti's work on perspective and painting and updated it to be even more useful for artists. So Luca learns perspective from Piero, and then Piero introduces him to Alberti, and Luca later becomes an assistant to Alberti. It's like a triangle of everyone collaborating together.
So I have to ask you, off the cuff, how Da Vinci comes into this story then?
For me, that was definitely one of the more interesting stories to write in the novel, having previously written a screenplay about Leonardo da Vinci. I loved writing all of Leonardo and Luca's scenes together because they were such an odd couple. Luca Pacioli is a friar and a classically educated academic who has entree to the best courts and tables in Italy. And Leonardo da Vinci is brilliant, but he is considered a craftsman in his time. His work depended on having a patron. And Leonardo was born out of wedlock, so he was never classically educated in Latin like Luca was. We like to think of Leonardo da Vinci as this all-knowing genius, but he relied on Luca to help him calculate the perspective in The Last Supper, which is a big thing. So for me, I really liked writing their scenes together because I like the idea that Leonardo needed Luca, but he has all these chips on his shoulder from his childhood, and he doesn't like that he needs Luca, especially someone like him who he views, you know, erroneously, because Luca did not have a privileged upbringing, but he views him as having a privileged upbringing, and the beginning of the relationship is fraught, but they eventually become friends.
So what was Luca's upbringing?
Luca's upbringing was as a relatively poor, as far as I can tell, meager existence in San Sepolcro, Italy. We know that he had probably an apprenticeship in a shop, and then, but he was not born of means. It's not exactly clear when his parents die. So I had his parents die in one of the black plagues, you know, because it wasn't just one black plague. It was many different black plagues at many different times. He studied at a Arabaco school, so he learned Roman numerals and mathematics there. But then it wasn't really until Leon Battista Alberti gave him a job with Ron Piazzi in Venice that he really got outside of San Sepolcro.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. And it seems we find with many of these characters in these books, travel is so important to their lives.
Mm-hmm.
That it helps them grow and change.
Yeah, I definitely have Luca think to himself, come across this quote in the library of Urbino, the Duke's library in Urbino. Plato's quote is, don't tell me what books you have read, tell me where you've been and I'll tell you what you know. And Luca, not having traveled the world, you know, can travel the world in these books in the library in Urbino, but it's not until he gets to Venice that he realizes the limitations of that knowledge.
Oh, that's a beautiful thought. Because who doesn't love books? But then you have to add to that.
Mm-hmm.
Who were his major competitors, and how did they measure up to what he did?
It's a very interesting question, because he didn't invent the Venetian double-entry bookkeeping method. He codified it. It's a method of bookkeeping that was in place in Venice at the time, but there were many different forms of it. People practiced it many different ways. So his main competitor wasn't necessarily any one person, but the chaos of all these many systems existing, and the idea that you could have all these many different systems existing in a world where international trade was growing.
I can see the problem pretty closely, which I think is interesting that he's the person who found a way. So why was it that people listened to the system he created? What was it about him that drew people to focus and to drill down into that?
The main reason people gravitated to Pacioli was because he was able to use examples and anecdotes from everyday life. And he also wrote everything in High Renaissance Italian, the common tongue of the day, instead of Latin, which was the language of academia, to make his writing more accessible to everyone, because he sees books from Greek and Arab mathematicians. Fibonacci, who very famously wrote a Liber Abaci about using Arabic numerals, the numbers that we know today, instead of Roman numerals. But that was 300 years before, and people weren't using it. So he took all of this information and tried to use those examples and anecdotes in order to get people to pay attention and understand these theoretical constructs through everyday language and situations.
Well, I love that. Do you have, off the top of your head, an example of that kind of an anecdote?
Yes, absolutely. It's the story of the twins. It's a story of the merchant Uini, who knew a dying man who wanted to make a will. His wife was with child, and he wanted the will to be different depending on whether or not the child was a boy or a girl. Mm-hmm. That was all well and good at the time until the baby was born. Or rather, babies. twins, to be precise, a boy and a girl. The will couldn't be altered because the man had already died before the children were born. You could, you know, take his will to a lawyer, but since there had been no precedent for this situation, one had to look outside the profession of lawmaking for answers. So how should the will be interpreted? And this is an example he gives in a mathematics class. So he'd tell his students about the rule of three. We knew the man's assets, how he would have divided them if his progeny were male, and how would that be altered if it was female? Male and female, you know, getting different amounts, you know,
right.
Politics aside. We know these three terms, and we need to deduce the division of assets in this unique situation, or rather, the fourth term. Using the rule of three, the fourth term is a simple proportion that can be deduced by the ratios between the other three, where if A over B equals C over X, then X equals BC over A. You got it? Was that clear enough?
No, high school algebra and no.
Well, I'm sure that Luca could have explained it better.
That's fascinating, though, and what a great way to look at an actual event that people could recognize and then try to put that in mathematical terms. I love that. So my question would be, I'm assuming that you didn't have an impression of him as you got started, because I frankly have never heard of him, but I wondered if you did, and if you didn't, how did you form that impression? What did you think about him in the beginning?
It's a very good question, because I honestly didn't expect him to be that interesting. The people who do know about him sort of know him as the double-entry bookkeeping guy. But he wrote the first textbook on mathematics, and he wrote books on chess, and he held court with popes and the greatest artists of the day. He was, in many ways, the smart Forrest Gump of the Italian Renaissance, witnessing, influencing, and producing some of the era's greatest achievements. I didn't expect him to have so many different connections to everything that was going on around him in the Renaissance.
That's fascinating. I love that, because so many of these people, again, who traveled, met with very important other people, and they did influence each other as they went. And we just don't realize that networking has been around forever. So you touched on this a little bit. Let's see if there's more to when you started researching him. What was the coolest thing you found out about him, the neatest piece of research that you came upon?
One of my favorite bits about Luca Pacioli was that he was a friar. And I know that's not a very small thing about him, but for him, it was such a big thing in his life. I found it so interesting how he used his faith to inform his work, especially his work on the divine proportion. The divine proportion being the golden ratio. People at his time didn't call it the golden ratio until the 1800s, so nowhere in the book will you see it called the golden ratio, but that's what people call it today. He called it the divine proportion. So it was really interesting to get into his head and see that from his perspective. But there were all these little things along the way that he taught me about the world, like how to wash your hands in molten lead. Apparently, you can put your hands in molten lead as long as you soak your hands in cool water for a long time, and there's a little bit of alum in the water, which was something used for dyes at the time. Your hands wouldn't get burned, so it's kind of a magic trick.
That's almost like the way people walk on burning coals.
Absolutely.
Tell me this. What do you think in your own background made you capable of getting into his life?
The biggest thing was for me growing up in the middle of nowhere, similar to Luca Pacioli. I grew up in north central and northeastern Montana, an area of the United States that last year the Washington Post did a technical analysis of the United States and determined that northeastern Montana was the technical middle of nowhere. So I definitely understand what it's like to grow up in a very small community, go to libraries, get introduced to the outside world, and want to go out and explore. So it's that yearning, especially imagining where he's coming from at the start, the forefront of the Renaissance, that really made me connect to his character.
That's wonderful, because that's the hardest thing for writers. We can't all be the person that we're writing about, but we have to find some connection, and it has to be emotional. So, this being a work of fiction in many ways, what would you say is the favorite scene that you wrote that you really enjoyed writing, you think really brought the character out?
I have a few, if you'll indulge me. So we talked about Leonardo da Vinci and Luca Pacioli. After they leave Milan together after the French invade, they go to Mantua and stay with the Marquisa Isabella d'Este, who teaches them about queen's chess, a new, faster version of chess, a la rabiosa, they called it, to the rabid. This new style of chess, the one we know in the West today, in China they still play by the old rules, and in this version, the queen, formerly a vizier, an advisor to the king, is much more powerful, and games are much less likely to end in a draw. I loved writing this scene where Isabella d'Este basically schools Luca and Leonardo in the new rules and then proceeds to dominate them in a game, showing how deft and skilled a woman can be when she's given power. Another scene that I loved writing was when Luca lays eyes on Botticelli's Birth of Venus for the first time. Luca was in Florence when Botticelli painted it, and I love the idea that Luca was at the unveiling party for the painting, and everybody is fawning over it, being a sycophant, and Luca, having been trained by Leon Battista Alberti and Piero della Francesca, the two leading men at the time in the art of using mathematical perspective in painting, he looks at the painting, which, for Luca, has this very flat background, and it's not mathematically accurate, and Luca decides that the best way to endear himself to Botticelli is by telling Botticelli how to fix his painting, and how he can help him to do it. I loved adding bits where Luca interacted with people in the Renaissance, if only briefly, doing things also like meeting a young Martin Luther when he was in Rome many years before he nailed his theses to the door of the church. And since I'm writing in the first person in the novel as Luca Pacioli before he dies, he doesn't know what Martin Luther goes on to do either. So he's just somebody that Luca runs into at the Pilate stairs, the same stairs that Christ hiked up to in his trial. And Luca says a few choice words about indulgences that might have inspired Martin Luther later on in life.
That is the funnest part with the historical fiction novel. You want to play with the other people who are around and see what that influence could have been.
Absolutely.
Beautiful. That's beautiful. Do you think, going through his life, did you find any major themes that you played with and tried to stress as you wrote the piece?
Persistence. And perspective. And possibility and positivity. You know, all the P words, basically. He's not somebody who was always positive, and he was not somebody who always had things go right for him. He faced setbacks and loss, like the death of his mentors. But he always used his setbacks, in the end, to propel himself forward. And in this way, I think Luca has something to teach us, not just about mathematics or double-entry bookkeeping or the divine proportion, but about how we account for setbacks in our lives and how we determine what our legacy will be.
Again, an emotional connection that anyone can make, whether they're interested in math or not. So we've mentioned mentors a little bit, and I'm interested if there were any mentors in his family that you think helped him or that you used in the book in some fashion.
Yes, his brother had two sons who also became friars, but in my estimation, they didn't become mentors to him until much later in his life as he was going through his novitiate, as he was going through the training to become a friar.
And do we think that he is listed as a mentor to any particular people?
Absolutely. As a professor, he mentored many people. Using the skills and examples that I laid out before. But one of the most famous people he mentored was Guidobaldo de Montefeltro, the Duke of Urbino, who inherited his dukedom when he was 13 after his father died. And Piero, who was Luca's mentor, had been mentoring Guidobaldo already before Luca. And it was at Guidobaldo's father's library in Urbino where Luca had that first taste of the immensity of the outside world. So Luca naturally wanted to mentor this young boy who wanted to prove to everyone that he could rule at such a young age, similar to how probably Luca felt as a young boy in the library. Luca was the first mathematician to have his portrait painted by Jacopo de Barbari, and he had Guidobaldo in the painting with him. And he had also dedicated his mathematics textbook to Guidobaldo as well.
That's a beautiful thing. If you're going to dedicate something, it must mean that you feel connected to that person. Oh, that's beautiful. So I'm aware in the novel you end every chapter with a number that's in the succession in the Fibonacci system. Why did you choose to do that?
Because when you take any two successive, one after the other Fibonacci numbers, their ratio is very close to the golden ratio, the divine proportion, which Luca dedicated a part of his life to. And the higher and higher you go with Fibonacci, the closer the relationship between those successive numbers gets to the divine proportion. The closer their relationship produces that irrational number, which comes up with a surprising level of consistency in nature.
So I also discovered there's an Easter egg in the novel.
Yes. The Easter egg involves the Fibonacci sequence. And I'm going to announce it here. The first person to figure out what it is and also why it's an Easter egg, the why is very important, I will personally give that person $112.35. And if you know why it's that specific amount, you already have a leg up on the competition.
Oh, I love that idea. Well, then you're going to have to tell us, as best you can, not being a mathematician, what are Fibonacci numbers?
Fibonacci numbers are numbers that the last two numbers in the sequence add up to the next number of the sequence. So if we start with 0 and 1, and then we take those numbers and add it up, that adds 1, and then take the last two numbers, you have 1 and 1 equals 2, 1 and 2 equals 3, 2 and 3 equals 5, 3 and 5 equal 8, and you just keep going on and on and on, and the numbers keep getting bigger, and they grow bigger very quickly.
Well, as much as I hate to end these things, we do have an ending question, which I always think is interesting, which is, who have been your mentors in life?
I'm very lucky to have had a number of people really mentor me at different stages in my life. My high school English teacher, John Roberts, taught me the skill of how to sit down and start writing, a skill that I'm very proud to have today. In college, photographer Chris Killip artist Elaine Rychek and filmmaker video artist Elizabeth Subrin really opened up my eyes to what was possible as an artist and how to approach creativity. And nowadays, I would have to say that the writer and educator Ken Lezebnik, who we both are, you know, well acquainted with through the Stevens College MFA in TV and screenwriting, he's been very instrumental in the many facets of my current writing. And as you know, he's just a really great guy.
I agree. Well, this has been very wonderful. Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Mentors Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.